this week's programme, some reflections on how cinema has changed our lives over the past 100 years. Francine Stock's book is called Inglourious Technicolor, A Century of Film and How It Has Shaped Us. Francine Stock is quite explicit about her criterion of selection. Films are chosen not necessarily because they're the best of their kind, but because of the influence they've exercised, be it in forging a national identity, shaping our ideas about romantic love, or simply altering our ideas of fashion. She agrees that her selection favours Hollywood, but that's how things were, she says. With me, Peter Sheridan, screenwriter, playwright and director, Bob Quinn, filmmaker and photographer, Stephanie McBride, who teaches film studies at DCU and has written a number of books about the cinema. Stephanie, you've chosen an excerpt from Annie Hall, but perhaps you'd set it up for us.
I chose Annie Hall. It's from the 1970s. I think it was 1977. And I suppose one of the things about Annie Hall, as played by Diane Keaton, is that she actually has longevity as a female icon. And her clothing, which is sort of DIY styling from the 70s under kind of recessionary times, has that kind of lasting image. As well known, really, I suppose, as well remembered as Scarlett O'Hara's curtains for a dress. So in that sense, too, and I think Francine Stock chooses it specifically too because of that kind of fashion, which is kind of contrary to convention. But it's also, I think, it's got other tremors too, which is to do with sort of a feminist quality. It's a woman attempting to find her own voice, nervous, but nonetheless attempting to do that. So it's not just about the fashion, which obviously we remember, but it's also about that particular period in Hollywood, really, which is about new Hollywood cinema for women. And I think Annie Hall, as played by Diane Keaton, takes that up.
You play very well.
Oh, yeah? So do you. Oh, God, what a dumb thing to say, right? I mean, you say it, you play well, and then right away I have to say you play well. Oh, God, Annie. Well, oh, well. La-di-da, la-di-da, la-la, yeah.
You want a lift?
Oh, why? You got a car?
No, I was going to take a cab.
Oh, no, I have a car.
You have a car? So, I don't understand. If you have a car, so then why did you say, do you have a car, like you wanted a lift?
I don't know. I wasn't. I got this VW out there. What a jerk, yeah. Would you like a lift?
Diane Keaton and Woody Allen in the film Annie Hall. Bob Quinn, that distinction between, you know, films that are good of their kind and films that have had an influence, how does this stand out for you?
I was very puzzled about it. I had a couple of questions. That first was, why did Chatto and Windus, Random House, who was owned by Bertelsmann, publish this book? And I figured that out. They realised there was a niche in the market for a book about film, and this lady was obviously very well equipped to write it because she was a journalist, a current affairs writer, and an arts reviewer. So, and she happened, I presume, to have had hundreds of reviews already made for the BBC. So putting them together was not a major job, and I suppose that's it. And it was a niche. It should really have been a coffee table book, a tiny coffee table book with photographs, I felt, because it's really, for instance, she fails, as far as I'm concerned, to fulfil her aspiration, which was to tackle the ideas that she mentions. How could something as patently artificial as film seem so real, and might there be particular effects on our behaviour, both public and private? And she didn't succeed in doing that, and she says, we hunted in vain for a book that tackled these ideas. As if Wikipedia or sociology didn't exist, as if the hundreds and thousands of articles and pieces and books about film had never written, even though she does mention...
She does. I mean, in fairness to her, she...
Well, she mentions H.J. Foreman's book in 1935, called Our Movie Made Children. But she says, we hunted in vain for a book that tackled these ideas. These ideas have been tackled thousands of times in the last 100 years. Anyway, I found it very well written, and if I was a student of film, it would be useful to have an index like that to look up people, look up films, look up actors. But generally, it was a bit of a trudge for me to go through the book, I'm sorry to say.
And we also took note of The Devil's Camera by R.G. Burnett and E.D. Martell, claiming that the motion picture industry was the greatest threat to Western civilization. Now, where have we heard that before? That goes on and on. Stephanie, you were nodding there in agreement in when Bob was saying that she didn't quite succeed in her what she was setting out to do.
Yeah, I was a bit surprised when she claimed that there was no book that sort of covered that particular ground, because in film studies now, I accept it's an academic discipline, sure. But nonetheless, there has been quite a focus, certainly since the 80s, on audience and reception studies, and a great deal of work from, say, somebody like Richard Maltby, somebody like Janet Steger. Now, obviously, that isn't for the general populace, but it would be unfair to think that the audience hasn't been crucial in terms of theoretical work. And indeed, if you look at work coming through in postgraduate studies in Ireland as well, there's a good deal of work being conducted with people who remember going to the cinemas and trying to get that kind of empirical work done. So I was surprised when she made that claim as well. So I agree with Bob, yeah.
Peter Sheridan, what was your overall reaction to this book?
Well, when I got the book first, I went to the index to see where the films that I'd be interested in talked about. I mean, that was my first thing. I thought, is she going to talk about Helga, which was a film that had a huge impact on me and a huge impact on Irish audiences back in the 70s. It was the first film in Ireland that had shown female genitalia, so anybody who was interested in a naked female form went to see this movie, and people used to collapse at it, particularly men, during the birth scene. So it was kind of the first sex film in Ireland. It was an absurd commentary, really, on what it was to be Irish. I always think that Helga told more about Ireland censorship and how we were as a people than any other art thing that I've ever seen in the 70s. And so there's no mention of Helga in this book, but that's kind of a by-the-by. The first thing I kind of noticed was on the title page, Francine Stock with Stephen Hughes. And immediately my suspicions are raised when I see a double authorship on a book. I had an experience recently of coming through an airport in London. My wife is a big crime fiction fan, and I picked up a Tom Clancy book for her, whom I know she hasn't read, and I thought, oh, I might start her off on Tom Clancy. But when I got home, I realised it was Tom Clancy with somebody else, but in fact, Clancy hadn't written the book. They just put his name on it, because that's the way publishing has gone now. They need a marquee name to sell a book. And in this case, obviously, Francine Stock is the marquee name. And Stephen Hughes, who doesn't get any mention anywhere in the book of who he is, where
he comes.
You think
he did the work in there?
Well, there's definitely two hands at work in the book, because there's an awful lot of kind of incidental add-on stuff, cut-and-paste kind of jobs that drove me crazy after two or three chapters, where there's an argument being discussed or a point of view being discussed, and it sort of seems to be going somewhere, and then the argument of it stops, and we get all this additional information where suddenly we go from The Birth of a Nation in 1915 to some study that was done in New York in 1989, and I'm kind of going, why are we switching? You know? So that clearly was as it were, the researcher who presumably was Stephen Hughes, who had done all this research based on stuff which Francine Stock had done. So it felt like a cut-and-paste book to me, where the researcher was adding on stuff from the general drive of the narrative.
She is aware, Bob, it seems to me, of the provincialism implicit in her approach. You know, she says if this journey were taken in Russia, China or India, then you might get something and would get something quite different.
Yes, she does say necessarily skewed towards America. And I asked myself, why necessarily? There are thousands of films made every day all over the world. And the odd thing is that she does actually mention a lot of very good films from Germany, from Russia, from India even. So she goes out of her way to warn us that it's skewed towards America, which it is, Hollywood, of course, which would put you off. But as you go through it, she's referring to films of interest to me, because I gave up being interested in Hollywood films years ago. But just this morning, it occurred to me, now, what is she to say about Ireland, like Peter there? And I looked up John Borman, not mentioned. I looked up Neil Jordan, not mentioned. I also noticed that Robert O'Flaherty's Nanook of the North is dealt with in detail, but Man of Iron is not mentioned at all.
Yes.
And then I noticed that she doesn't mention very many brilliant German films, because the Germans have been producing the wonderful films in the last 20 years. Downfall, Heimat, a little longer than that. The Boat was about that time, and Sophie Scholl, things like that. Now, there's another thing. I will never forgive or forget this for not mentioning my favourite screen actress since Louise Brooks, and that's Isabel Huppert. She doesn't get it mentioned. Mm. Now, that's interested me because she mentions The Pianist, which is Polanski. She mentions the Piano, which is a Hollywood film, Holly Hunter, both of which were quite good, even though The Pianist was Polanski descending to Holocaust-type film. But she doesn't mention The Piano Teacher, which was a superb one. And what surprised me...
In fairness, though, I mean, you know, we could all, I suppose, yes, list things like course. That. But yeah. Stephanie, can I ask you, what stood out for you?
Well, I mean, I think Bob is right that even if it is skewed towards America, towards Hollywood, nonetheless, and this is going to happen in a book because it is schematic in terms of what she chooses. But when you set up an argument about certain wider political and cultural and social contexts and then omit films that I would have thought ought to be there, and I'm thinking particularly of the 70s, because you had in... You know, you had Watergate going.
Well, you've already had one. Forgive me, Annie Hall was 70s.
Well, yes, but Annie Hall was one thing. But it seemed to me extraordinary, even though she mentions The Parallax View, directed by Alan J. Pakula, nonetheless, she lets that go, and she doesn't focus in on that at all. It's selecting Carrie, I think, as one of her examples. And it struck me as odd that you wouldn't actually look at the paranoia conspiracy thriller genre, which was coming through at that time, very much tapping into the wider anxieties to do with the assassination of the two Kennedys, the assassination of Martin Luther King, and much of the paranoia thriller was actually tapping into that and, you know, touching on those tremors and tensions in the wider culture, and yet she kind of bypasses that. So for that reason, even if it is about Hollywood, she seems to have missed certain areas of that. I mean, there are other things as well. She talks about film noir, but seems to locate it within it just to do with influences of Freudian psychoanalysis, whereas in fact, film noir, you know, has so many quite interesting textured roots coming from German expressionism and that. And also, it's not so much that it's about Freudian psychoanalysis, but it's to do with, again, the kind of upheaval and times out of joint, because it was post-World War II, and there was a whole sort of dislocation, displacement of men returning. Women had actually entered the workplace. So yet all of those kind of shifts in roles and away from the domestic, and all of that confusion, which is very much informed and is seen by lots of commentaries on film noir. And again, she kind of tidies that aside.
I'm pleased to see, Peter, that she focuses on the role of and the importance of the blank face in screen acting. You know, that it's we who do the work. She's talking about stone faces like Garbo or Buster Keaton's, blank slates on which anything can be written. That's so true, isn't it? I mean,
she's good on that. But just to go back to a point that Stephanie was making, you know, look, I know how difficult it is in a selective process where you've got to make choices. But I would have been very interested to see what her take was on the birth of the recent Irish, you know, film industry, particularly something like In the Name of the Father, which, you know, is obviously a seminal film in terms of the Northern Peace process. And I thought, well, I'll forgive her for that because, you know, she's not dealing with Irish film. But then I realised she's actually dealing with the White House. She has a whole little section on films that were shown in the White House to various presidents, right?
Yeah.
High Noon is the highest rated film amongst American presidents, amongst US presidents. Now, it's well known because it's been documented that Bill Clinton rang Jim Sheridan after he watched In the Name of the Father and said he was deeply disturbed by the film and that he wanted to do something about Ireland. I mean, this is known, it's on the record. So there's a clear relationship between that movie and the start of the Irish peace process in the early 90s. Now, it would seem to me that is, you know,
she could be forgiven, I suppose, for missing that.
I can't because, I mean, for example, you know, in terms of, say, something like the Second World War, she has a chapter on the Second World War. She doesn't mention Casablanca, one of the absolutely seminal films in terms of preparing the American people for their entry into the war, with a film that is itself a metaphor for entry into the war, and it gets absolutely no mention. I have no idea why she decides not to mention Casablanca, but that's hugely an omission for me.
I have to say, I don't sense any agenda here of any kind. Do you, Stephanie?
In the book.
In her, yeah.
No, I don't think there's an agenda as such, but I think when you begin to select three films per decade, it's obviously going to contract and your choices are going to be. But that's why, in fact, I find myself focusing in on why this rather than that. Having said all that, and we've been you know, we've been sort of hard on it. I did discover one or two gems. For example, I was delighted that you reminded us of the Gold Diggers of 1933, particularly the song My Forgotten Man. And again, it tells you something about that because you can actually check it out and find it on YouTube, that particular clip. But, you know, we take musicals, Hollywood musicals, as sort of, you know, rags to riches, frothy fantasy. But in this case, the musical actually lodges a fairly powerful social comment, commentary on, you know, the poverty of the time. And I thought I had forgotten about that. It was, you know, she brought that to my attention. But there's one or two others too. You know, that sort of large maritime vessel we've been hearing so much about lately.
Yes.
She does mention that, in fact, I think it's in the Kabul marriage celebrations, choose that particular vessel, the Titanic, as an ornamentation for wedding cakes. Mm. Now, there's a little gem that we wouldn't have known before.
I mean, she's good. She's very, very good on certain things. I mean, I would be, you know, very laudatory about some of the stuff that she deals with. She's very good on D.W. Griffith's The Birth of a Nation.
Yeah.
And for me...
Is she right, by the way, in saying that that's been, you know, truly formative, that that really shaped a lot of film that came after?
Yeah, and I think what she's good at doing is she's good at, first of all, just kind of talking about how Birth of a Nation came about. But then the implications of what happened after that was that they suddenly, the filmmakers, realised they had a product that they could market. They didn't realise with early in the history of film that this thing was very marketable. It wasn't like having a theatre company where you had to send them around and book them into hotels. You had a piece of film that you could just put places. And cinema audiences grew. For example, like one of the odd outcomes of Birth of the Nation was the reviving and the fortunes of the Ku Klux Klan, which she talks about at some length, that the Ku Klux Klan as an organisation were on the floor until the Birth of a Nation, when the KKK completely revived as a result of that film. And she's very good at making those kind of deductions, which I think is what the function of a book like this should be.
Yeah, in terms of if she's to talk about influence,
exactly,
or social
the influence
yeah.
on society, okay, what happened.
To my point about screen acting, Bob, you who directed a lot of people who made the transfer from stage to screen, like Cyril Cusack and Donald McCann, there is something about screen acting that's different, isn't there? Sort of, you know, we talk of it usually in terms of less is more, if you like.
Yes, you mentioned an actor there, and I thought of, again, Isabel Huppert, who has that blank slate on which the audience paints emotions. Mm. And I believe less is more is the only valid theory, acting theory, that exists. And because the audience has an imagination, and a director who uses the audience's imagination is summoning up a power much greater than his own. Can I go back a little to that that reference to D.W. Griffith? Mm. D.W. Griffith's film did not change people's minds. It reinforced their prejudices. It was an entirely racist exercise, and it reinforced people's prejudices against the blacks. And this brings me back to the object of this book, which was to find out how film changed people. I don't think film ever changed people. The people who drive motor cars now are the same people who drove them 100 years, not the same kinds of people, but the motor car had a much greater effect on society than film. Films merely reacted to what was happening in society and reinforced various prejudices and fears that people had. In other words, film is really a fairy tale, always a fairy tale. That's why it has such a dreamlike quality. And it plays on and reinforces or relieves us of our fears as children. And we're sitting in the dark watching these giants, 30-foot giants on a 65-foot screen. No
so
wonder.
You're really saying it doesn't change. But this is said of all media, Bob, isn't it? That it reinforces and doesn't change.
And film is no different.
And do you agree, Stephanie?
Largely, but I think it's interesting the way in which I think Peter referred to this, that they were able to use The Birth of a Nation as recruitment for the Ku Klux Klan, so that even if it doesn't change people's minds, it can be pressed into a particular service.
Yes.
And in this case, it was pressed into service. But in terms of not changing people, it may not change people overnight or just with one screening, but I do think the power of cinema is also about just prompting questions sometimes, or thoughts about things. And
well, may I interject there? I do agree that watching a particular output from a particular studio, say Hollywood, over 50 years, as I've done, can have what they call an accumulative effect on people's attitudes to life and to other people. But it is like a child. If you keep telling children fairy tales until they're 70, they will never emerge into adulthood. And that, I suspect, and I believe, is what Hollywood does. It keeps people in a state of infantile fear.
But you seem to be making a distinction here, Bob, between Hollywood movies and what's happening in continental Europe.
Huge distinction.
Do you agree with that, Peter?
Yeah, because I would agree and disagree with Bob at the same time. I mean, I remember going to see Misha Era as a kid when I was a child, being brought from school, and it had a huge impact on me. Had a huge effect on me.
What effect did it have?
Just the feeling of, one, that there was actually moving images and pictures that related to my life as a child in Ireland. I thought that movies were something about people far away that didn't really relate to me. And yet here was a kind of a potted history of the birth of our nation through a series of images.
I mean, she does claim to talk about forging national identity. That would be a very good example of it. I think O'Riordan did help, did contribute
greatly
to that. Yeah.
Greatly.
Sorry, Bob, go ahead.
So I believe film does actually can have an absolutely powerful effect. And I think that's something like, to go back to In the Name of the Father, I think In the Name of the Father changed a lot of people's perceptions about the fate of people, Irish people in England during the 1970s and 80s, and people suddenly realised that not everybody, you know, who was caught up in the conflict or in the Troubles was a member of the IRA and out to bomb people.
It was very important, yeah.
People were really shocked by this, and so it had an absolutely critical impact on public opinion and preparing people for a re-examination, a re-look at that whole issue. And I think that, you know, not just that film, but many other films. The Battle of Algiers, for example, which was banned in France for 5 years after it came out because they were so afraid of the impact it might have on French public opinion. So I think cinema has particularly had an absolutely huge impact on being a former of public opinion.
It's a bit like propaganda, Peter. I think I believe in Diego Rivera, and he said that if it's not propaganda, it's not art, and that particularly applies to film. Even James Bond is propaganda of the crudest kind for Western capitalism. All films, accidentally or intentionally, are propaganda. And for instance, the war effort in the Second World War was lived on propaganda on both sides, the Germans and the British, and it was a brilliant skill the filmmakers had, but they were reinforcing the nationalism of the very.
But that's true. But since then, Bob, though, you've had filmmakers with a much more critical posture who would try to,
absolutely,
you know, subvert all of that.
I shouldn't apply the word propaganda to all films, sure, although I do believe it. But film is about persuading people, right, to feel something.
Were you surprised to see, for all that she says, you know, this is all about Hollywood and how Hollywood waited, to see her talking about the Mexican director of Silent Light, Carlos Reigada, who uses real time in a movie? Now, that strikes me as really the very quintessence of courage for a cinema maker to do.
And also the reference to Uncle Bonmi and his unpronounceable director.
Uh-huh.
I found that, and that's why I think Peter was right, that it was kind of cut and paste. Oh, we better stick in something here to show that we know something about bits everywhere.
That's a bit unfair, perhaps. No, but I mean, you think that she was... But nonetheless, what do you think of that idea? I mean, as I understand it, he's talking about the use of about a continuous, unedited shot of a tree on a hillside, which lasts more than 5 minutes.
I think it's a great idea. Warhol did it with the Empire State Building for 24 hours. Yeah. And it's a very useful idea, but that's in the area of conceptual art, you know, where the person actually can't do anything, but they say what they're trying to do, and people say, "Oh, that's art. The conception is wonderful." So it's chancing your arm a bit, you know, and it's trying to be a bit different. The most interesting development, two developments I see in this whole business, is one, the adoption by graphic artists of film. There was a girl, Claire something, who used to make beautiful films. She was an artist, and she made beautiful films a la Patrick Carey. But I notice increasingly artists, graphic artists, painters, sculptors, are using film much more. And it's, I'm sorry to see that, really, because it suggests to me that they've lost confidence in their fine art activities. The other thing is that it was said to me by, I think it was the marketing director of Columbia Pictures before he was fired, and he died recently. And he said to me, I said, films, of course, are now being made for 20-year-olds. He said, no, they're being made for 15-year-olds. And the last film this woman mentions in her book is Avatar, which was the greatest load of cobblers I've ever seen in my life, which cost the most money and made the most money. because it was aimed at 15-year-olds.
Well, on this very point, at the end she says that funding we know now is available for two kinds of film, those that cater for young audiences and for niche audiences, that middle-budget dramas more popular with the middle-aged are struggling to get funded. Is that your sense, Peter, of what's happening?
Without question. Yeah, that's definitely been the trend. The trend has been towards young people's films. The majority of the tickets really are bought by under-17-year-olds.
So the whole movement
of those recent, you know, vampire movies, which are aimed at that kind of teen audience, so it's a combination of Bram Stoker and teen fiction, you know. That's where the market is going right now. But, I mean, one thing, and you know... Bob and I would probably agree on many, many things, but I think that American cinema and Hollywood gets kicked unnecessarily by people on this side of the world for not being brave enough. But if you look at the 1970s and you look at the anti-war films that were made about Vietnam, they completely changed American perceptions about Americans.
Well, television did that, in fairness, well, Peter, more than film.
Well, film did it. I mean, you look at Apocalypse Now, The Deer Hunter, those great Vietnam films, they were absolutely seminal in shaking up Americans thinking about their involvement in Southeast Asia.
It reminds me of what an American film, a Hollywood film producer said to Kurt Vonnegut when Kurt said he was writing Slaughterhouse-Five, and the Hollywood producer says, I suppose it's an anti-war book, and he said, Kurt Vonnegut said, I suppose it is. And the Hollywood producer said, you might as well write an anti-avalanche book. And it's the same. A war film is celebrating violence. There is no such thing as an anti-war film. They're exploitation of war films. And that's about the size of it.
That's a cynical view, Bob.
Well, it's a fairly realistic view, but probably in my old and angry age. I see war films as disgusting.
Stephanie.
No, it was just something Peter mentioned earlier about, and Bob, but this, you know, the idea that funding for particular films aimed at young people. But actually, it's not just at the level of, in the point of production, because actually audiences are changing that too. I was reading recently about the Everyman Cinema in North London has ripped out the seats as they used to be, put in very luxurious sofas with tables to attract the greying audience, the older audiences. So obviously that also has an effect on the kinds of films that will be produced. Remember too, the youthful audiences that they sought to bring to the cinemas for so long are actually, you know, they're distracted by social media. They get their kicks elsewhere. In fact, they're more likely not to pay to go to the cinema and rather to download. I think there's, you know, canons are changing, orthodoxies are changing, and audiences are changing. That will have to have some impact on funding. Remembering too, it's important that we see our own stories told, and I think that's what Peter was talking about with Misha Era, but also the kind of resuscitation that has happened in Irish cinema as well, that our own stories are being told on the big screen.
We've been discussing in glorious technicolor A Century of Film and How It Has Shaped Us by Francine Stock, published by Chatto & Windus. My thanks to Stephanie McBride, Bob Quinn and Peter Sheridan. You can listen to the programme again on our off-the-shelf website at rte.ie. Till next week, bye-bye.